This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
I am Wang Xiaoning, and this is The Breakfast Grill. The gap between the haves and the have-nots has widened. Global growth is slowing, while climate change and the rise of populism has thrown the world into a flux. To help us make sense of this, we have with us Dr. Jomo Kwame Sundaram, a prominent development economist trained at both Harvard and Yale, who was a member of the Council of Eminent Persons and is part of the Economic Action Council. Welcome to the studio. Now, Dr. Jomo, do you think we are heading for a global recession or a real slowdown? Is it difficult times ahead?
I think the situation in the world has been grim for at least a decade, since the financial crisis of 2008-2009. Unfortunately, the efforts to address that crisis were not very good. The situation now is much more dire as a consequence. At that time, I was working for Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, and we proposed a global Green New Deal.
At the United Nations, right?
Right. Unfortunately, the global part of it never took off. There was no seriousness, particularly on the part of the rich countries, to have any kind of international solidarity. In fact, we find that there was a certain degree of protectionism all around, especially by the developed countries. This was stemmed partially, but now, as we know, protectionism has become almost fashionable in not only in the rich countries, but also in some developing countries. This, of course, has very important and consequences for the possibility of growth on the previous basis. But I think more importantly, we have not only lost an opportunity to stimulate the world economy and resume growth on a more sustainable basis. Very importantly, I think we have also lost an opportunity to try to address issues involving sustainability, particularly environmental sustainability. And most importantly, I think our proposal was involved questions of how to address global warming. The situation is very, very dire. I don't want to exaggerate, but it is so serious that it's not even funny. And we need to have that kind of international solidarity. But unfortunately, international solidarity has broken down, and the kind of ethno-populism and ethno-nationalism, which we see particularly in the West now, is such that it is very, very unlikely that there will be a resumption of the kind of solidarity or even multilateralism, which is so much needed in order for this situation to be addressed, not only on the question of economic growth, but also on the question of sustainability.
And Dr. Jomo, I mean, like you say, you know, there's the rise of this populism, and, you know, one example of that is President Trump in the White House. He also has taken a very hard stance with regards to global trade and has effectively divided the world into almost two camps. So you've got the US camp and, of course, the China camp. It's almost like a Cold War, post-World War II, but fighting on an economic front. Is this something that we're going to just have to get used to?
I think, to be fair to Trump, although he is a caricature of those who are against serious multilateralism, this kind of attitude has been there for a long time, what I consider to be essentially a neocolonial attitude. And this was also true, for example, during the period President Obama, for example, was president. He basically had little interest, zero interest in concluding the Doha development round of trade negotiations, which have been going on at the World Trade Organization, or WTO, since 2001. He could have easily agreed to conclude that. In many ways, it would have set certain precedents which could have been very helpful. But unfortunately, he chose not to do something about that. But also in other respects, the kind of solidarity in terms of trying to deploy resources at the, not only at the national level, but also at the global level, to try to help the poorest countries in the world to begin to address their problems. You can't address the question of global warming without also addressing the question of poverty. Poor countries don't have electricity. And you can't say, oh, it's too bad, we're going to raise the price of carbon. What you need to do is to create the kinds of incentives so that renewable energy becomes available for them. And you bypass the fossil fuel stage of electricity generation. This is a real possibility. And the economics of, for example, generating electricity from using photovoltaic solar panels is very efficient. It's clean, but also it's competitive. And Malaysia now is in a very strong position to become a major producer and exporter. Unfortunately, the companies which are doing that are all foreign companies. There's absolutely no reason why Malaysian companies cannot quickly access that technology and develop it. The technology is not as complicated as, say, trying to build a car. The other huge opportunity, of course, is palm oil-based biodiesel. And, it's a real pity that we have not handled the whole European criticism of our palm oil much more effectively.
Yeah, the powers of the lobbying group in Europe, they've been very clever in their campaigns, right? But what can we do actually to counter some of this negativity that is in Europe? I mean, one of the things they're not going to do, they're not going to use palm oil in biodiesel from 2030, which is going to impact us for sure. Mm.
I think there has been a change in the discussion around the health issues, and we are still campaigning on the health issues as if the world has not changed in the last 3 or 4 decades, you know. So we continue to insist that palm oil is safe, that it doesn't contribute to heart disease and so on and so forth. And we have a tough sell. It has helped a lot that, for example, coconut oil. When I was a student, I was trying to sell coconut oil from door to door. And coconut oil in those days was used for hair shampoos, for car, washing cars, everything but human consumption. Today, it has changed, okay? But the debate is still continuous, okay? And making the transition from coconut oil to palm oil is not something which can easily be done. So there is that issue, and we need to get the science correct on that. We have to be honest about it rather than just selectively choosing the science which serves our interests. But the issues have changed. We find, for example, there's a strong criticism of deforestation. There's a strong criticism of land grabbing, taking away from Orang Asli and the natives of Sarawak and Sabah, for example. We have to recognize that there is some truth to some of these criticisms. If we are in a denial mode, we're not going to convince anybody. Okay, you can try to convince the Malaysian population, but that's not going to get us very far as the rest of the world is concerned. And refusal to engage with the EU ambassadors and so on has not been our best interest. We cannot just say that there's a big conspiracy out there, which there is, okay, and then hope that righteousness will prevail, especially when we are not all that righteous.
Yeah. There's no point denying something if it's the truth, right? Rather, maybe more important is to address the issues head on. Mm-hmm. But then, Dr. Jomo, you referred to the national car earlier. So are you keen on this third national car project as part of Malaysia's industrialization plans?
Well, I'm not privy to any of the serious discussions about it all. I personally feel that we have a car industry, and I think pushing for a third national car, especially in the current international environment, would not have been my own priority. But I don't want to say too much about it without looking at the details of what is being proposed. And I have not really looked at the details. Unfortunately, proposals such as the third national car and the flying car and so on and so forth do not give industrial policy a bad name. We have a situation in this country where, unfortunately, the industrialization process, which began in the late 20th century, has basically been undermined from the time of the Asian financial crisis, but there has been no concerted effort. And I think we need to continue to industrialize, but not necessarily on the basis of the old car industry, for instance, but looking forward to a number of things. I also think that we need much better economic negotiators which would get a better deal, for example, with Geely, a better deal with many of the
multinational companies.
Yes, yeah, and we also need to have much better deals with as far as plurilateral as well as bilateral agreements on investment and trade are concerned.
Yeah, since you brought up trade, I mean, let's talk about free trade agreements, because from an opinion piece you posted in June with the title "A Bad Free Trade Agreement is Worse than Nothing," you're clearly not in favor of Malaysia signing this comprehensive and progressive agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership. But we've been fed this diet, right, by the government, that these trade agreements will actually be good for the country. It will encourage more foreign direct investment, supposedly creating high-paying jobs. Is this not the case?
Far from it, unfortunately. I think the case for the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, in the first place, was a false claim. You know, President Obama and his U.S. Trade representative, Michael Froman, made it very clear that the whole motivation behind the TPP was to isolate China, was to, you know, surround China. It was essentially politically driven. And so, in my view, it was not a smart idea to be involved in something which is explicitly against China. I don't think we should become the Chinese stooges, but neither should we be explicitly aggressively against China. And in this regard, I think Tun Razak's advice of having a zone of peace, freedom and neutrality is very important guidance. And Tun Mahathir has also reiterated those kinds of commitments. But as far as the so-called advantages of joining the TPP is concerned, the main advantage would have been better access, slightly better access. Frankly, the so-called gains are very modest, but the slightly better access to the US market in some areas. Mm. But the negative implications, particularly, for example, in terms of strengthened property rights, in terms of something called ISDS, Investor State Dispute Settlement, are so considerable, besides the fact it was actually going to be negative on the trade side, that we really needed to reject the TPP. Now, the CPTPP without access to the US market is even worse. We would have an increase in some exports, undeniably, but a far greater increase of imports. And these imports will be, number one, Japanese cars. Okay, because Australia, Singapore and all that, they don't produce cars. So Japanese cars would come in a big way. And basically, the Malaysian, you can say goodbye to Proton and Perodua. Now, some people who have opposed Proton and Perodua would see this as desirable, but I think it would be disastrous. The second largest source of imports would be accounted for by plastic, including plastic waste. And it's not a coincidence that the three largest sources of import of plastic waste today are Japan, Australia, and Singapore, respectively. What do we want to do? Yet another issue, I think, for example, is that it would become even more attractive to be a foreign investor in Malaysia than to become a Malaysian investor. And you basically are creating a bunch of perverse incentives, encouraging companies to go the Grab way.
You're listening to The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking to Dr. Jomo Kwame Sundaram. After we come back, we are going to ask if free trade agreements are really good for the country. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to an extended Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking to Dr. Jomo Kwame Sundaram. Earlier, we were talking about the lost decade after the financial crisis of 2008 and asked if we have squandered a chance for a fairer economic model for all while looking at some initiatives the government should consider to boost the economy. And you talked about China earlier, and the world, like I said, is kind of divided into two camps. How should Malaysia align itself? I mean, at this juncture, if you just look at the headlines, right, it seems that we're more in favour of China by virtue of the projects that we're doing together, be it Belt Road Initiatives or even the ECRL. But how do we not get caught in this crossfire between, you know, these two superpowers? How can we actually benefit?
As I suggested earlier, I think we need to be neutral, okay? We just generally need to be neutral in terms of our foreign relations, our international relations. We have a very unfriendly regime in Washington today, and you have a friendlier regime in Beijing. Okay, but these things change from time to time. We are a small country. We are not in the position of taking on fights with big powers. You know, let's face it. That's the bottom line. So what we need to do is to walk the tightrope, which is going to be very difficult, of being friendly with other countries, especially our major trading and investment partners, economic partners, and not get into avoidable disputes with many of them. It doesn't mean that therefore you give them a blank check to do anything they like. One has to be vigilant. One has to look after the Malaysian interests and protect the Malaysian interests. The problem with the last regime was precisely because it was up for grabs to the highest bidder. So it was friendly to the US, it was friendly to Japan, but especially to China. And you had a lot of abuses associated with some investors, not necessarily the Chinese government, but you had some abuses, which have now been partially checked. We need to be vigilant, but you cannot reject China like that. I mean, that would be cutting off your nose to spite your face. So I think we need to have a much more consciously proactive policy in terms of advancing Malaysian development interests without necessarily falling into any political camp.
And Dr. Jomo, the other thing I want to talk about is rising inequality. Because earlier on, you mentioned that basically we've kind of lost this opportunity, this lost decade, right? After the great financial crisis, where actually the rich just seem to get richer. And, great wealth has been created, of course, from the stock market. If you just look at how the Dow Jones is or NASDAQ, because we do see tensions coming to a boiling point, and not in just poor countries, but in countries which appear to be quite well off. So the likes of Chile, for example, I mean, GDP per capita of 15,000 US a year. Hong Kong, GDP per capita of 50,000 a year. You know, so lots of appearances of wealth, but they mask this social inequality or income disparity, right? So will we see more of this in the coming decade? I mean, are these trigger points?
Okay, I think one has to look at the question of economic inequality and the measures of economic inequality. You can have measures of economic inequality which suggests overall economic inequality is going down. Okay, and basically, since the introduction of the NEP, it appears that overall economic inequality overall income inequality has been going down. However, you raise the important question of wealth inequality. And wealth inequality has probably been far more concentrated today than ever before, both at the global level as well as at the national level. But I think the inequity of the system, including the taxation system, is perpetuated by the fact that many of the richest people in this country hardly pay any tax. About half of the people who own luxury cars, loosely defined as 2 liters and above, don't even pay income tax. And so we have a great number of perverse incentives working in the system, and we do not have a progressive taxation system. Contrary to what many people think. People think that, when you pay tax, it is essentially progressive. Unfortunately, it is not. So you have inequality in income, which contributes to greater inequality in wealth, where a great number of the richest people are able to obscure their wealth to avoid taxation. So the system of taxation largely affects the top 30%, although something like GST and SST may affect the next 50%, put it this way. So we have a system which we all think is progressive, and actually it is not progressive. It has not been progressive, but has become even less progressive over time because we have gotten rid, for example, of most of the wealth taxes. We have gotten rid of the
inheritance tax. Are you keen on those kinds of taxes, whether it's capital gains tax or inheritance tax, for example?
I think we should consider the wealth taxes and the likely and what the likely impact of those taxes are. Some taxes attract a lot of support because they may actually yield relatively little. But I think what we do have in this country, we used to have those taxes. Mm-hmm. And instead of making them more progressive, we have got rid of them. So we have almost no taxes on wealth, no taxes on property or assets, and we have And it hasn't contributed to more investments.
And Dr. Romo, I mean, we go back to the topic about this wealth inequality or this income inequality. Do you see the government's shared prosperity vision 2030 as something that can address this imbalance?
I think we still have something on the books, which is called Wawasan 2020 or Vision 2020. I think it is still very relevant, and all the elements of Vision 2020 should continue to be the priority for the nation. Then we should also, at the same time, do a critical evaluation of the shortfalls in terms of achieving Vision 2020.
Rather than just move on to shared prosperity 2030.
I think it is premature to announce that. Then there should be a far more broader discussion as to the problems of Vision 2020, both in terms of the basic conceptions as well as the implementation.
Okay. And Dr. Shomo, we also, you know, one of your pet topics, I would say, is privatization. You refer to it in your book, Malaysia at 50, and also in a lot of your postings. But here in Malaysia, we're seeing a bit, maybe perhaps a rewind of it, right? Because in the Pakatan Harapan Manifesto, one of the things that they said they were going to do was to look at toll roads. Do you think it's a good idea to unwind existing projects which have already been privatized, like, for example, Plus Highway?
I think in the late 80s, you know, people like Lim Kit Siang and others were opposing the privatization of the North-South Highway. And I was in that number as well. I had my own criticisms of privatization generally, as well as the North-South Highway. And as Tun Mahathir admitted at that time, the main reason for privatizing the North-South Highway to UEM was precisely to ensure that the funding for the PWTC, the Putra World Trade Center, the headquarters of UMNO, was adequately funded. Okay, now 30 years hence, we have a situation where, unfortunately, highway concessions have been given to a great number of companies. Basically, they are mints for all these companies. And I think that was a huge mistake. But is the solution renationalization at this point? Given the priorities which we face in this country, including the Pakatan Harapan Manifesto, there should be a greater earnestness in terms of identifying those things which will improve the well-being of the Malaysian people. All I'm saying is I'm not dogmatic about privatization and nationalization. And for companies like EPF and Khazanah and so on, in this very uncertain international economic environment, it's important for them to hold on to
stable
assets which would generate relatively fixed incomes. Mm. Okay, and so I'm not keen on forcing
like a reverse privatization a way. Would you rather we take the money that we may, I mean, hypothetically spend on something like Plus Highway, which some people say is 30 billion ringgit, for example, and actually just put the money into the pockets of the poor, a form of a helicopter money for Malaysians?
No, I don't think so. Just giving money to poor people doesn't necessarily mean desirable outcomes. What we really need to do is to try to ensure the well-being of people. I'm not suggesting a overly nanny state, but this is extremely important if we are going to improve the conditions. I don't think any Malaysian takes great pride in the fact that we are among the top three most obese countries in continental Asia, or the top three in terms of diabetes, competing with Jordan and Brunei. These are things which should be matters of public policy. It has huge consequences in terms of the well-being of Malaysians and ill health, raising the cost of healthcare unnecessarily.
You're listening to an extended Breakfast Grill where I'm speaking to Dr. Jomo Kwame Sundaram. After we come back, we're going to talk about nationalization and if that makes any sense while taking a look at Mahathir's fourth regime. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to an extended Breakfast Grill where I'm speaking to Dr. Jomo Kwame Sundaram. Just a few minutes ago, we were discussing the threat of rising inequality and what reforms should be prioritised by the Malaysian government to address this. Now, just before the break, you mentioned the rising cost of healthcare. Is there a lack of reform here? And how much has the government neglected the well-being of Malaysians?
I think we have to recognize that over the last four decades or so, there has been a lot of reform of the healthcare system. Unfortunately, much of it has not been for the better, because you have increasingly private interests moving in to try to see what are the most lucrative elements of the healthcare system, which could be privatized, and how they can make money and so on.
Yeah.
And we continue to give huge incentives to for setting up private hospitals. The result of these perverse incentives is that you have an excessive capacities in the private sector, and you have undercapacity in the public sector. So you have, for example, machines which should be used, you know, around the clock, which are underutilized, MRI machines, for example, and CAT scan machines and so on, which are underutilized in the private sector and the public sector. So we need to address some of those problems. But the fundamental problem of healthcare, you know, Malaysia used to be among the top in Asia and among the top in the world, given its relatively low income in those days, up to the 1980s. What we have seen now is that there are a huge number of private interests who are trying to see what they can get for themselves. What we should be thinking about is the welfare, the well-being of principally of the citizens, number one. But also, I think what we also have is a situation where we have a lot of doctors now.
They claim excessive number of doctors.
And we need to improve the system.
And so we're on the topic of reforms, because we talked about healthcare, we talked about other reforms are pressing for us in Malaysia.
I think almost everybody agrees that education reforms are very much needed. And in many ways, I wish that Prime Minister Mahathir had taken the education portfolio as he wanted to. Mm-hmm. He would have been bold in terms of bringing about some of the education reforms. But I think it's not too late. I think what we do need is a continued discussion, and a discussion which is much more informed by the changes in the world. Right now, we have very packed curricula. And the belief is that if you pack this and require that, you'll get a better outcome. But we also need to recognize that almost half the poor children in low-cost flats in Kuala Lumpur, for example, do not have access to tadikas.
Mm.
You know, so there are childcare facilities which need to be improved. If we are serious about getting more women into the labor force, we need to begin to think about some of these issues. Right now, we don't have the correct incentives. And so there is need for reform all around. But I think education is something which, you know, where Malaysia spends a lot of money.
Yes.
Yeah? Unlike with health.
Yeah.
But with health, we have had, at least in the past, pretty good outcomes. In education, although we spend a lot of money, I don't think we have very good outcomes.
And Dr. Jomo, you know, let's go back to this tough times ahead, right? But we see a slowdown. And one of the things you say is that government should be counter-cyclical and flexible when it comes to budgets. So you're suggesting fiscal spending, but I can see the logic of that. But then how do we ensure that projects that we kind of push forward are not wasteful, for sure contribute to growth? You know, where's the accountability? And
two areas which I have been personally active in. One is the whole question of using the budget to resume the industrialization process. So particularly to facilitate, without waiting for the industrial master plan and all that, to push a couple of new initiatives, for example, in pharmaceutical products, you know, rather than, and much of this will require the government to
so
take
you're
in
not
the initiative.
Keen on the projects that have been announced, let's say all these transportation projects, whether it's the East Coast Rail Link, I mean, there's even talk of resumption of high-speed rail.
The ECRL was a scam to basically cover up the losses of the 1MDB, and also to finance the last general election. I think that is pretty clear from what we know. What needs to be done right now is to basically scrap the whole thing once and for all, and basically do much, much more for the East Coast, because I don't think that would have helped. The problems of the East Coast are not really that they are deprived of transportation. The big problem, of course, if, for example, in Kelantan, there are a huge number of problems associated with water, the quality of water, the quality of sanitation, And then now more recently, because of the clearance of the highlands for agriculture, flood control. Kelantan is the poorest state in the peninsula. Terengganu has all this wealth from oil and it's not necessarily been terribly well deployed in the past. So a lot of work needs to be done for the East Coast. That I think we must be committed to. But ECRL was basically a scam and we should recognize it for what it was.
Mr. Jomo, you know, I have to ask you about your time on the Council of Eminent Persons, which of course has been disbanded, that there was this report. It's never been made public, right? It's under the Official Secrets Act. But just a gauge, I understand that within the report, there were some suggestions of reforms. Have you seen any of these reforms actually being implemented after a year?
I think one has to be transparent about what actually happened, okay? So the council operated for 100 days as it was. The report was prepared subsequently by the secretariat, including some of what was discussed and including elements which were not discussed. Okay, so I think one has to put that in perspective. Now, some of what was discussed was investigative. And I'm not sure that those elements should be published. So I was cautious about the publication of some elements which were sensitive, either because they might be considered libelous or because they have diplomatic implications. Mm. So those are my main concerns. But otherwise, I have no objections to reporting what we discuss. Now, as far as the proposals are concerned, which were prepared by the secretariat, I think we never really had a full discussion of some of those proposals. And those proposals need to be discussed before being presented as the report of the council. The third element is that there was a committee which was created. The committee which basically came about with reforms on governance. Four of the five members of that committee were basically lawyers and the other one, eminent general. Now, they wrote that report with a view towards publication. And I'm very happy for that report to be published in toto because that's what their intent was. But I think full responsibility has to be taken for the actual proposals which are made. And unless they were really discussed by the council as a whole, I think it cannot be presented as if they were they were council proposals. Now, it doesn't mean that the proposals are not good proposals or shouldn't be considered. You know, but I think responsibility has to be taken by whoever is making those proposals, and I'm not sure we have a consensus on all the issues. But I think Tun Daim is correct. We should publish those elements which are unproblematic.
And Dr. Jomo, you know, I refer to your book, Malaysia at 50, which you wrote in 2014 with Wee Chong Hui, right? There is this part entitled Mahathir's Three Regimes. Now it's going to be 2020 very soon. And let's say the publishers come to you, Dr. Jomo, please come up with a new edition. What would this new chapter, Mahathir Four Regimes, be like?
Well, I think depending on when Mahathir steps down, it would have to be a wholesome assessment of his legacy as far as that is concerned. I think it's very important for us to put everything in context. And what I do about in talking about the first three regimes is to talk about the changing context and how his policy initiatives tried to respond to this context as he saw it. Mm. Just like Tun Razak introduced the NEP to address particular problems as he saw it. Okay, so I think it's very important to always recognize that. But I think the other element which is going to be different I mean, besides the fact that, you know, there's a lot of distortions and damage as a consequence of the Asian financial crisis and some of the measures which were introduced to deal with it, and then the legacies of the two subsequent prime ministers. All that needs to be put in context. But the fact is that the world has changed. The world has changed, and you cannot be harking back to policies which may have been appropriate in the 1980s or even in the 1990s in this day and age. Rest assured that I'm not planning to write another book. I think even that book was very difficult to complete because I was actually not living in the country from 2004.
On that note, thank you for spending time with us, Dr. Jomo, on The Breakfast Grill on this and having this very honest discussion. I'm Wong Xiaoning for The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.